This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello and welcome back to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be on white-collar crime. I am joined by Senior Barrister and Head of Chambers, Neil Hawes QC, from Crucible Chambers in London. Neil has over 30 years of experience in advising on serious criminal business and regulatory offences and investigations. Renowned for his exhaustive preparation and strategic foresight, he specialises in bribery and corruption, fraud, DPAs, cartel investigations and insider dealing cases. He remains well known for his down-to-earth and diligent approach, and Neil has been consistently recognised in the legal directories such as the Legal 500. Neil, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Hattie. Hello.
White collar crime. So white collar crime today comes in many forms. While most people envision white collar crime as something along the lines of the wheeling and dealing, as in the well-known films such as The Wolf of Wall Street, unexpectedly, most white collar crime happens in everyday settings. It is estimated that 25% of households will be victimised by a white collar crime. And the most recent white-collar crime statistics show that the UK is losing around £190 billion to fraud per year. When I looked at the breakdown of this, I did find it fascinating because it was £140 billion for the private sector, £40 billion for the public sector and £10 billion for individuals. These are big numbers. So let's explain, please, Neil, to our listeners, what do we mean by white collar crime and how serious is it?
It's a term of art, actually, white collar crime. I mean, the truth is it is criminal offences that's often connected to serious, as you say, wide ranging financial crime. Commonly, it has significant values. You're talking, as you've pointed out, millions of pounds are involved. Sometimes cases are of very high level public interest, and that's not just in the sense of it's interesting to the public, but it also is related to offences that affect the way in which people behave. So there's been a lot of publicity recently about phishing. There's been a huge increase in phishing attacks for people to have monies taken from their bank accounts, and or pension frauds. Those are quite common. Now that would fall within the criteria of white collar crime. Individuals could be prosecuted for very relatively low levels amount of fraud, for example. But white collar tends to be the more senior, high level individuals who are being sought after by the authorities and who they think are controlling in some significant way high value frauds, high public interest matters that impact on either all of us as individuals, whether that's through what we purchase, or sometimes it can affect markets even, such as the stock market and the behavior of individuals in our society. So they can tend to be very, on the one hand, very complex cases to investigate and prosecute. That tends to be more within the definition of white collar crime than the smaller level amounts of fraud. You do tend to, as a practitioner, tend to see a type of individual that's involved with it. They are often people that control companies. Usually, in my practice, I often represent people who are statutory directors, that is, directors of the company themselves, or on occasion non-statutory directors, but people that call themselves directors, such as a commercial director, but they're not actually listed at Companies House. Often there are international elements to it. So by way of example, you can sometimes see people that are committing crimes abroad, or they have companies abroad, or there is communications with individuals abroad, because crime has become much more international and much more sophisticated. And it's that kind of thing, Hattie, that really falls within the sort of definition, although there's not a strict definition of white collar crime as such.
Yes,
it
tends to
be that higher level stuff.
I hear you. And, you know, breaking it down in the most simplest terms, you know, if an employee of a company writes a check to themselves for a personal expense,
yeah,
then they have essentially, in the simplest terms, committed a white collar crime.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they will have committed theft in that situation where they've taken money from the company, which they're not entitled to, and they could be prosecuted. And that would fall entirely within that definition. Lots of people don't think of those sort of, if I describe that as a single offence, say the individual has taken money out of the company account, they don't think of it as white collar crime at all. I mean, it's interesting the statistics that you pick up on, because actually you're absolutely right. I mean, there's often published reports, whether it's from some of the big firms of accountants or indeed the Fraud Advisory Service, that look at things that are going on. It's the frequency with which those types of offences are being committed in everyone's businesses day in and day out. Now, the truth is that in this day and age, lots of that type of offending, with the value that you've described, often actually goes undetected.
But this is the thing. This is the thing, isn't it? Because when we look at what types of white-collar crimes are out there, as you say, we don't automatically, I think, as consumers, think that somebody taking from the till of the business, from the purse of the business, is a white-collar crime. We kind of see it as theft. It's theft.
Yeah.
They've stolen. But you don't relate it necessarily automatically in your mind to fraud. And you don't certainly think of white-collar crime. But it's very interesting that you say, you know, it does relate to higher level cases that are detected and are prosecuted. I mean, it was interesting because according to the crime survey for England and Wales, as of June 2019, there was over 2.5 million cases of bank and credit card fraud, which was on the rise, up from 17% the year before.
Yep.
962,000 cases of consumer and retail fraud, which is 4% on the rise from the year before, and 47,000 cases of advanced free fraud, which is when I think fraudsters target victims to make advance or upfront payments for goods and services.
Yeah.
But you're right. There's so many different levels of fraud, and computer fixing fraud, online shopping fraud, check and card and bank and online fraud. But really what we're saying is white collar crime is when a person steals from that company purse, basically, whether they're an employee or not, or somehow associated to the company.
You can do it in a number of ways, but ultimately, at the end of the day, I mean, as I say, white collar doesn't really have a definition at all. I mean, actually, at its heart, it is a financial criminal offence.
It does sound very fancy to say white collar crime. No, I have to say
it does.
It sounds very fancy.
It really does. The truth is, there's such a wide spectrum of what you're talking about. So, you know, taking the example that you give of the individual who has taken some money out of the till, or by taking a cheque, for example. In practice, as a lawyer, you would look at that as an individual crime. You would represent that individual charged with theft, stealing the money in the circumstances you've described. You probably wouldn't, as you say, it's called a fancy term, you probably wouldn't actually think of it as white-collar crime. We tend to, as lawyers, as you rightly say, aggrandize these things and think they're much bigger cases at the other end. So say, for example, of the statistics that you've described, say there is a large organized way in which people are being defrauded of, it's a classic one at the moment, pensions. There's a huge amount of work going on because of the liberalisation of pensions where, you know, people get cold call, they've got their pension sum, and people are misled into misspending their pensions. Now, if that's organised in a systemic way somewhere, possibly abroad or possibly in this country by individuals, that would tend to be more white collar crime definition, because you've got an organiser, you've got a hub. And actually what they're doing is systemically taking lots of people's money and therefore taking millions out of the system criminally. And that tends to fit slightly more the definition of white collar crime, in the sense of who investigates it, who prosecutes it, and its complexity really to get the case going in terms of the investigation. So a simple case where you take the money out of the till, yes, it is white collar, but actually would be relatively straightforward to prosecute or investigate and prosecute. Where at the other
as
end
a
of
theft.
The spectrum, as yeah. a theft. At the other end of the spectrum, you might have a huge number of individuals involved in a very complex arrangement who could be prosecuted for conspiracy to defraud, or for conspiracy to steal, or for fraud itself. And that is a different beast, actually, to get going, because it takes a lot of investigation, maybe international investigation.
Cross jurisdiction laws. Absolutely. And now that we're out of Europe, it probably gets even more complicated, because that's what who prosecutes white collar crime? I mean, the interesting thing you said earlier was that not much of it doesn't go detected. And I read a statistic that said that nearly 90% of white collar crime cases are never reported to law enforcement authorities. That's I mean, and we've just, you know, I reeled off billions of pounds worth of fraud, white collar crime fraud. So if 90% of it are never reported, then imagine what those figures actually are in true terms, which we'll never know, of course.
Absolutely. I think there's a range of reasons for that. I mean, the depressing end of the reason is that, you know, sometimes, particularly if it happens to companies, and you know, I've been in situations where I've advised companies where they've made the decisions not to pursue individuals for what they think they have done, but they deal with them in employment terms. They may sack them, they may give them no references. And it's as much about, yes, they accept that there's an offence being committed, but sometimes on occasions, corporate clients don't necessarily want to expose themselves to the publicity associated with what's taken place.
So to say that they don't want to say, look, we've had this kind of crime. Yes, I can totally get that, because then their clients are going to think, oh, really? So clients, whether it's B2B or B2C, the clients for that company will naturally think, oh, so you've got somebody, you've got people inside stealing or misusing.
They don't want to expose themselves. Sometimes
so that's very interesting.
Companies don't necessarily want to disclose that there are or have been exposures within their internal systems. And equally, there is also, I would say, in fairness to some, particularly the more senior companies that you represent, there is often with their boards a very balanced approach, almost a sort of judicial approach, actually, when you come to how they make their judgments, which you advise them upon, which is, well, yes, all right, A may have committed a crime, but there are mitigating circumstances. It could be their age, there was illness, there were some other aspects going on. And they take a balanced judgment whether to pursue those individuals by reporting them, or whether they think the punishment of, you know, being dismissed, possible implications on pension rights,
maybe a fine or something like that, repayment plan. I don't know if the sums are measurable. But so if it's going to be prosecuted, who does prosecute white collar crimes?
It depends on the seriousness of it. So the principal prosecutor in the United Kingdom for serious white collar crime is obviously the Serious Fraud Office.
Now
they have thresholds to cases that they will adopt, and I'm sure lots of your listeners will have heard about the SFO. I mean, that their published threshold is that there's got to have an impact of at least 5 million. In other words, the fraud or whatever they're looking at, the bribery, usually in this day and age, is either fraud or bribery and corruption that they principally focus on. It usually has to be about 5 million, or it has to be very high public interest, or often it's got both. And sometimes because of the complexity of the investigation. So the SFO is the principal prosecutor for really high level white collar crime. So that is things like libel, Things like bribery and corruption, lots of their cases, well publicised cases, including deferred prosecution agreements as against corporate entered companies. So things like Rolls-Royce was something that was investigated by the Serious Fraud Office and Tesco's. There are lots and lots of those kind of companies that they have looked at. And there's, in the last year, they've had a huge settlement in a deferred what's called a deferred prosecution agreement with Airbus. So that's that very, very high level. But they're not the only individual. The Crown Prosecution Service, the CPS, also have their own fraud prosecution division. And sometimes there is a division between the two of them. Sometimes that is based on, you know, is the finance, is it complex, and that kind of thing. And then there are specialist prosecutors as well, who also take on what would be regarded as white collar crime in this day and age, as you mentioned that I do. So, for instance, the Financial Conduct Authority, the FCA, they have one of the principal leads for prosecuting particularly city offences and usually insider dealing, which is also regarded as a white collar crime. Or at the other end of the spectrum, cartel activity, where two individuals or companies have agreed with one another to fix a price or to share a price, etc., which is illegal. And so the Competition and Markets Authority, the CMA, can prosecute that. Although, interestingly, there is a bit of a crossover between the CMA and the SFO. The SFO has recently agreed with the CMA under a memorandum of understanding that if it's particularly complex, the SFO might take it over with the assistance of the CMA. And so in this day and age, you do see a sort of combination of investigating authorities. The Pensions Authority, which has recently acquired the ability to prosecute for pension offences, is both, you know, potentially looking at the opportunity to prosecute individuals itself, but it is also simultaneously working in collaboration with other police forces and indeed the SFO on much more complex international cases.
So just to get an idea, I mean, if you've got the CFO, the CMO and different bodies with an interest in prosecuting, it will only be one of those bodies that will ever prosecute. Yeah. It can never be two, for example, saying, well, we've got an interest because of this element of the case, and the other says, well, we've got another interest because of that element. It will only be one. And it's interesting that you mentioned the memorandum of understanding, because clearly everybody wants the business by the sounds of things.
Well, they do. It's interesting. They do. Although you see the CMA, the Competitions and Markets Authority, is an example, a good example, where they started down the route of prosecuting for cartel activity. But by reason of a couple of Crown Court cases not going their way, they didn't get the results that they wanted. They, I'm not critical of this, they've slightly pulled away from the idea of prosecuting, and they haven't actively prosecuted so much for those offences, rather than taking them down the civil route and or using or combining with someone like the Serious Fraud Office to allow the Serious Fraud Office to do the heavy lift for the prosecutions that are probably more adept to prosecuting for offences of that type than the CMA themselves are now.
So
they tend to, as organisations, all cooperate and talk with one another. And there is always an election ultimately by one of them taking the principal responsibility for prosecuting, but the others may well support them in that. And there's certainly a cross-fertilizer information between them.
No, interesting. Very interesting stuff. So, I mean, what's the most common punishments for white collar crime? And I know that's another big question, but let's talk about the most common across the board. If you could say, actually, over all the years that I've done this business, that's probably the most common punishment that I have seen. What would it be?
Imprisonment, usually. I mean, you know, when we're talking about a wide range of offences, of course, there's a huge amount of outcomes that can happen. So taking your example for someone who, say, had taken a check from their company, which was pretty low value, they may have all sorts of personal mitigation as to why they have done that. And any judge, when you get to that point, has to look at the seriousness of the offence and then balance that against the mitigating features that are relevant to that individual. Now, judges in this day and age, as you know, Hattie, will work under what's called the set for a lot of offences, but sentencing guidelines. So they have guidelines that they can apply to the particular case. Now, it's important to stress that they are only guidelines. They're not tram lines. They're not stuck to those.
Yes, because the judge has the ultimate decision. I mean, the amount of time, for example, in my law firm, when you get asked questions about what's the judge likely to do, well, you can always say what the judge might do, but it is the judge's ultimate decision.
Yeah, so they have a range of options. So at that lower level, say someone had taken, I don't know, £200 or £300 out of their company. Yes, it is a white collar crime, but the truth is it is very unlikely, even if there was what's called a breach of trust. Say someone was an accountant and they were in a breach of trust position, that would make it more likely that they would reach what the lawyers say the threshold to go into prison. But there may be lots of personal mitigation that brings them back down beyond that threshold, which means that they wouldn't go to prison for their sentence, and they may have a community sentence of some form. At the other end of the spectrum, in the kind of stuff that I do these days, you know, if it's bribery and corruption or serious fraud, where you're talking about commission of offences that may have been going on for years, you know, conspiracy.
Or has that high value over the threshold of 5 million, or it's in the public interest
You're talking 15, 20, 30, 40, 50 million. Or you know, in the case of LIBOR, which I was involved in, I mean, its financial implications, not just for the individuals concerned, but to the markets, were in its trillions.
Oh, goodness, yes.
So in those circumstances, you know, prison sentences are high. You're talking 10, 11, 12
years.
Well,
you get more for, I think, fraud, more a longer prison sentence for fraud in most cases than you do for murder.
Well, yeah, you can.
That's the myth, anyway, Neil.
You're going to get an automatic life sentence. So and murder in this day and age has significantly higher sentences than when I first started because of the various amendments to the law. So murder sentences are.
But you hear it, don't you? That is a myth that I hear all the time. You get less for murder. It's almost used in jest as well. Oh, you would get less for murder. I mean, I actually found myself saying that to my dad, who's been married to my mum for 54 years. And I said, Dad, you'd get less time for murder.
But most people forget. I mean, I do the odd murder. I don't do so much of them these days. But you do forget that actually, you know, anyone who's committed a murder is, you know, very unlikely to face a minimum sentence less than 20 years, quite frankly. And in any event, you will be on licence for the rest of your life.
Mm. Convicted and charged, absolutely. No, I get it. I get it. But it's interesting because I'd like to cover this area as well, Neil, because I don't think we can ever do a podcast again without covering the impacts of COVID-19. On what's going on in life. So how do you think COVID-19 has impacted white-collar crimes? I mean, I know we've mentioned that online, because of online usage of everything, you know, banking and connecting with people and transacting and working. I mean, there's lots and lots of people literally on the 23rd of March 2020 went from turning up to the office to being able to work from home, most because business had to go on in some form using their own IT equipment. And I say that word sounds so archaic, but what I mean is, you know, their own computers. If my 14-year-old heard me saying that, he'd probably go, Ma. So, you know, using their own computers and phones. And, you know, you're talking about banks and insurance companies and all sorts of any business. You know, every business has a financial element, you know, for HR departments and accounting departments, and everybody had to work from home. So what have you seen? What would you say has been, you know, the biggest impact in this area because of COVID?
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the absolute truth is we live our lives more online now than we have ever done. And that includes storage of personal data, whether it's financial information or your date of birth. I mean, how many of us, you know, now we have systems where you say, well, do you want to save your password on your browser, for example, and things like that? The truth is, organised crime, which some white-collar crime really is at one end of the spectrum, take the examples of people using phishing emails, etc. I mean, that's just organised crime. when you get criminals who are that ingenious, and we all use what we use online, criminals will find a way to expose those weaknesses. And lockdown and COVID has simply illustrated that as an example. I mean, it was only on the radio today that, you know, phishing attacks and fraudulent attempts to acquire people's accounts. We all get emails where suddenly someone, you don't recognise it, and they say, click on the link because you're...
I've got one sitting here, honestly, where I was sent an email to say you've got a voicemail from your answering service. Now, I have got an answering service, and the emails come headed from my answering service, and I'm thinking, and it says click here to listen. So I went and clicked it yesterday, and this is, and you know, and I only did a video for my audience a couple of weeks ago saying, here was a text message I got. Are they pretending they're the post office, you know? Don't fall for it. And then I fell for it myself in an email because it was so well designed and put together. Now, God knows what they achieved by me clicking on that, because nothing much happened on my screen. But I am worried. What did they get? What information was collated as a result of me clicking, you know, that link?
I mean, there are levels of sophistication in relation to that. And that's not, you need a real expert in that area. But my understanding is, depending on what you've clicked and how you've clicked, they can acquire personal data from you, or, you know, on occasion they can bang a Trojan into your system to access things. I suspect that probably hasn't happened to you, hopefully. I mean, and the reality is, I mean, because of COVID, that has all accelerated. So in our lives, we get all of these things all of the time. But more widely, what is the effect on white collar? So we've seen that escalation, the opportunities that criminals are seeking to expose to try to access either our personal data and using our personal data for different purposes, or usually trying to gain access to our bank accounts, as you rightly say, or frankly, just duping people into paying money over, whether that's what's, you know, sometimes they've been long running. They're not so popular these days, but things that used to be called boiler rooms, where people would phone up, I hate to say it, it tends to be older members of the community who have money, and they would pressurise, sell them down the telephone to buy useless shares, for example. And people had huge amounts of money taken out of their account.
I've seen TV programmes, actually, where independent sort of commissioned people, you know, journalists, have gone on the chase of these individuals who have orchestrated and owned and put these things together. But it is worrying, isn't it? Because when you look at sort of the average age for fraud, the statistics say, forgery statistics, that the average individual reporting a scam was 49 years old, with the majority of victims in most categories of fraud falling between the ages of 40 and 60. Now, I don't know what level of our population is between the age of 40 and 60, but I tell you, it's a damn lot of us. And then rental fraud was a clear outliner, and the average age of victim age of that was 33. And then, you know, you look at victims of ticket fraud, online shopping fraud, and auction fraud had an average age of 37. So, you know, these are ages where 33, 37, I mean, I'm older than that, and that's that. But you think, no, they're shrewd. They get it. They're completely with it when it comes to online. I mean, you know,
individuals are pretty savvy about those kind of things. But the truth is, we all lead busy lives. You get these things sent through to you, and then we're all used to clicking, aren't we? We click on everything.
I did it yesterday, Neil. As I said, I did it.
You just don't think about it, and click on it, and then suddenly...
And I think that's what it is. I think because we're so busy, even, you know, in a pandemic, that because life and the way we operate has changed. I've never done as much online shopping as I've ever done in my life, as I, you know, in the last 10, well, I'd say 12, 13 months, because all our food shopping's been done online, you know, because we haven't been able to venture out into supermarkets. My husband's a vulnerable individual, which is what's kept us at home more. And you just think, God, like you say, you click on something and it's double click on the side of your phone to authorise the payment, and your payment's gone. And you think, I have ordered things that I wouldn't normally order from certain places and websites. I mean, I do try to stick to mainstream Amazon and things like that. But
we love the convenience, it creates the footprint, which allows potential criminals to expose, you know, your online process and your profile. I mean, that's one end of the spectrum that we probably all certainly need to be aware of. I mean, at the other end of the spectrum, In terms of COVID. I mean, my experience is it's obviously like the world, you know, let's be honest, when COVID initially hit and we went into the initial first lockdown, you know, legally speaking, lots of investigations by implication slowed down. And so particularly at the more heavy, high end, the SFO kind of cases, you know, they, in fairness to them, they got back up pretty quickly, but they had to think outside of the box. So they were doing some interviews remotely on videos. Letters of request, in other words, material that's being sought from abroad, has had impact, obviously, because we're all suffering from COVID. And then, you know, every jurisdiction has had difficulties in responding to COVID. But interestingly, Brexit's also had an impact.
I was just going to say, on top of the pandemic, we had Brexit, and we've had all the laws have to change around that. So, I mean, it's extraordinary. I think, you know, would you say there's a backlog now in investigation? Yeah.
I mean, I can say definitively there's a backlog. I mean, I have clients who are under investigation, and you know, at the higher end of the spectrum, you can anticipate, certainly with the Serious Fraud Office, if you are ever in the unfortunate position that they come knocking at your door and start an investigation against you, I say to all my clients, you've got to anticipate 5 to 7 years potentially before they make a decision about whether they will charge.
That's a long time. That's a long time. And goodness gracious.
Two clients on 7 years at the moment.
Goodness gracious.
And if the decision is to charge, because of the nature and size of these cases, that's why I say at the other end, that's one of the reasons why white collar has such a flexible sort of approach to it. At that top level for the SFO, you're anticipating, you know, between charge and coming to trial, not least because of the court's backlog, at least a year, possibly longer. Because they're often huge cases to prepare. You're talking
and the way we work, the way, you know, the way everybody works has changed, and you know, and you've got to catch up with that. You've got to catch up with that backlog and then do the new work that's coming in as well. So
it's just simply also, I mean, just to give you an illustration. So, I mean, you know, in my practice, and in fairness, lots of white collar has been digital for age, paperless, more or less paperless for years and years, actually. So the SFO has always served lots, because of the size of it, their cases electronically, and they still do so. But so one of the cases I was involved in, if you were to take your disc and you were to print all your papers out,
it'd be a few truckloads, wouldn't it? In some cases, in the bigger cases.
Oh, God. You're talking millions of documents.
That's a lot of trees as well, Neil. That's a lot of trees. That's a lot of papers. That's a lot of everything. But Neil,
so you get used to using search terms, and your client and you and your defence teams, your solicitors, all of the barristers involved in it, prosecution and defence and the court all have to take quite a lot of time to just literally read it and understand the issues. And when you're defending, get your clients' instructions, what they say about what happened, and you know, the important documents become particularly important, you know, who did what when. Sometimes that's not straightforward when you're talking to a client who is trying to remember sometimes 7, 10, 15, 20 years ago.
We were involved as part of a small part of a bigger team, and I tell you, the papers used to come in truckloads. There was literally rooms of lawyers going through and sieving through. But Neil, that's all we've got time for.
Okay.
So thank you. Thank you ever so much for today. Thank you for your big, big brains, as I like to say.
Really enjoyed it. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I hope that we can do some more podcasts. We can cover some other areas. We can string out white collar crime and do segments of it and sections of it to break it down to our listeners. So thank you so much for your time today. What I'll say to our listeners is, don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts, and you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn and YouTube by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you for listening.